Pat, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for turning out on this rainy night to hear about reading, this thing that we seem to already know how to do, and yet, as soon as we ask, "So, what do you do when you read?" we tend to wind up like this lady up here. This is a painting by Corot from about 1870 called Interrupted Reading. And it seems like a good starting point for this lecture. I had thought about calling this actually a non-lecture because talking about the history of reading, I start reflecting on the fact that the word lecture actually means reading. And in fact, in the original European universities, that is exactly what a lecture was. The professor sat up in his high seat and read a book to the students. The full-pays had their own copies in front of them to follow along, and the scholarship kids took notes because they did not have their own copy. This is not the format that I choose to take tonight. And in fact, I'm going to be doing fairly little reading in this talk, and I hope that a couple of things will come of this. I'm going to introduce you quickly to this field of the history of reading, which includes moments like this, talk about some of my own work that I've been doing in the history of reading with a couple of different projects that might not seem related at first, and then see if we can find a synthesis of all of that. And I'm hoping to do that in a short enough time so that we'll actually have a slightly extended Q&A period from what we usually do. Now, this might mean that I open myself up to the criticism of Watts that Samuel Johnson made in his Lives of the English Poets, saying that he has done better than most what no man has done well. But we'll see if this format is actually going to pay off. So, one thing that I want to start out talking about is in the history of reading, there are a number of different strands that have been pursued for a number of decades. One is the history of literacy, which tends to be in history of education, comes often out of education schools. There is a social history dimension of this, which tends to take very macro views, looking at institutions, looking at very wide swaths of readership, often what are identified as working class readership, such as Richard Altuck's study, The British Common Reader, which is about 60 years old at this point. There's another strand which might be the most high profile up until recent years, which takes the history of reading more in what could be called a history of ideas direction. Because often the traces that are left in reading practices come from elites. People who not only know how to read, but they know how to read very, very well with very nice materials and with lots of friends to help them work with those very nice materials. So think, for instance, of Anthony Grafton's work, which he spoke on in this room just a few years ago on Renaissance annotators and books and how these form communities of reading. That's one kind of history of reading that focuses on ideas. And often these histories are anchored by interesting anecdotes. One favorite anecdote that gets quoted quite often comes from Augustine's Confessions from the 5th century, in which he talks about his mentor, St. Ambrose, in Milan. Ambrose, he says, would sit in his study. You would walk into his study, and he would look like he was just sitting perfectly still, doing absolutely nothing. And then you would walk over to him and realize that he was reading. The reason that was surprising was because his lips weren't moving. This is an image from a manuscript of the Gospel of John from right around the time that Augustine was barging into Ambrose's study. And a couple of features here that historians of reading have argued about for quite some time. The facts are there are no punctuation marks and there are no spaces. One line of thought has been this means that the only way that you can read these kinds of manuscripts is by reading them out loud, by sounding them out, figuring out where the words are. Other people say, well, no, that's not actually the only way that these were read. And so there's some debate as to what Ambrose in his study actually means. But he is often seen as one of the first key moments in the history of silent reading. I'm going to be doing something that's just maybe a step or two above anecdotes going through this. This is not going to be an exhaustive lecture, but I do hope it will be somewhat provocative as I go through. One of the things that this anecdote hopefully begins to show is that there's certain kinds of evidence that we might be able to use. The evidence tends to be scarce. It also tends to be fairly opaque. What does it mean to have a manuscript that has no punctuation and no spaces? There's a lot of room for debate in there. I'm going to take you through some other kinds of evidence, some other kinds of methods for how we might try to get at reading. And along the way, I'm also going to be talking a bit about the problems as well as some of the discoveries that I think we might be able to make with these methods. Now, when we talk about reading, one thing that's also important to keep up front here is that there are a lot of things that go on around reading. It's very difficult to figure out what goes on when we read. William James, in one of his late essays, writes that one of the reasons why it's so hard to talk about reading is that when I sit down and read a novel, my dog has absolutely no idea what it is that I'm doing. If my dog doesn't understand, how am I going to explain this to my students or explain this to my peers? There's no behavioral resonance that's going to explain what happens when we read. You could see maybe the eyes moving back and forth, pages turning. That doesn't necessarily help you get at that. So we have to try to triangulate into that mysterious interior experience through other methods. One method that I've been pursuing has been working on a set of library records that have miraculously survived in this very town. There are very, very few American libraries that have substantial pre-Civil War records that survive. A few years ago, a scholar who teaches at another institution but had done some of his dissertation work here told me that there was this big cache of library records in Easton, but it was so big you would probably have to live here to work with it. So I was just finishing up my book on Epic, and I thought, well, yeah, let's take a look, see what this is. It turns out there are 50 years worth of loan records for the Easton Library Company, a shareholding library that began in Easton in 1811. It's generally considered the first public library in the Lehigh Valley. This library did not work the way free libraries do today, where they're tax-supported and you get your card because you're a resident, and then you start checking out things. It's much more a 19th century Netflix. Originally, there were 100 shares to be bought. Very quickly, those were bought by Easton residents, and people would then be entitled to so many books over such a period of time for each share. And you could buy multiple shares if you wanted to have lots of books to bring home at once. There are a couple of ways to think about what this tells us about the history of reading. One thing it doesn't tell us is what people were doing with the page turning when they get home. That part we don't necessarily know about, but we can get into what I call aspirational reading. And what I mean by that, this is something we've all done. You want to read a book, you hear about it, you think, wow, that sounds really good. You go to a library or a bookstore, you pick up a copy of it, and then it sits. And then if it's a library book, you got to bring it back. If it's something that you bought, well, you might need to buy a new bookcase to figure out where those things are going to go. In the Easton Library Company, we can't know what happens in the home, but we can know what people were interested in reading. That's the aspirational dimension. What did people think was worth putting on the shelves, and what was worth taking off the shelves? So I'm going to start with the putting on the shelves. Because this is a shareholding library, the users of the library have a lot of input into what gets acquired. There's a board that's in charge of this, but the board takes a lot of suggestions from the readers. And this is the last catalog that's put together for the Easton Library Company. It peters out in about 1862, again, starts in 1811. The Civil War basically kills this library, and eventually its collection made its way into the current public library, kind of the grandchild of this institution. What we see here from the last catalog that was prepared is the percentage of subjects defined by the librarians there in the 1850s by genre. And a couple of Excel students and I, as well as a team of digital librarians, have reconstructed the catalog for this. And so we've been able to get a sense of how much is on the shelves of each of these categories. And as you can see, fiction dominates the collection, which is unusual for a shareholding library at this point, especially one that is modeled on the Library Company of Philadelphia, which was the pattern that these guys were trying to follow. The Library Company of Philadelphia actually wasn't all that interested in fiction. It wanted serious reading. It wanted stuff that would help you understand the politics, the history of the world, that would help you understand science, that would help you understand the great thoughts of the world. Fiction wasn't part of that priority. So the Easton Library Company is fairly distinctive at this point by emphasizing that. One of the things that we're trying to figure out is precisely why the fiction collection grows the way that it does. The directors say it's because they're trying to attract readers that are not used to serious study, and they can at least teach them the love of reading. One director's report actually says it's because women are using the books that they include the fiction. This is something we're starting to do some empirical work on this and finding some really interesting patterns as far as how much men are reading fiction. It turns out men are reading a lot of fiction. But also what kinds of works women are also reading. I'm not going to go into those during the lecture. We may come back to that in the Q&A. But as you look across some of the other major subjects, you can see magazines are a huge draw at this, the periodicals category. Newspapers are also included in that. History and travels are very big, as they also are in the Philadelphia Library. Belles Lettres includes poetry, literary essays, plays of the time. So we get some of a sense of what kinds of subjects carried what kind of weight with this particular readership. These are the things that they wanted to have available to them. But what happened when they took things off the shelves? That's the next part of the evidence that I want to take a look at. This is an example of what these loan records look like. By the time we're done building the database of these records, and some of my Excel students are actually in the room, I saw Elena Principato here, who has done a lot of work transcribing these records. We'll have about 60,000 of these records by the time we're done with this, I think. And what we're starting to find as we go through this is that certain works don't necessarily stack up as far as what's coming off the shelf in relation to what was already on the shelf. So fiction might not be flying off the shelves as fast as we're generally led to believe. Or if it is, it's in competition with some other things. Let me show you one preliminary scan that we've done so far. Once we got through about the first 15 years, we're about 20 years into the 50-year set of records. Once we got about 15 years in, so we're up to about the mid-1820s, we decided to see what were the top 20 most loaned titles in this particular library. And there are a number of surprises here. One thing that maybe is not entirely surprising is that magazines are very high up on the list. People are taking out lots of magazines. There are lots of magazine issues to take out, so that will also drive up the number. One thing to keep in mind here, the higher the volume total, that's this column right here, the more of an advantage that a book will have on this kind of schematic, because we're looking for every time a volume is taken out. That's one loan, and that's what's counted over here. The number of volumes certainly help this out. And that may be part of what helps Shakespeare to just squeak into the top 10. There's a 17-volume set of Shakespeare. But if we look elsewhere in the top 10, we see four magazines. The top one, it turns out, is actually an error. This is one reason you can't just have computers doing these things. We were shocked when we saw the works of Edmund Burke topping the list. It turns out that that should be somewhere around 100 loans, not 750 loans. I'm still trying to figure exactly what we did that made that do that, but just forget about Edmund Burke for a moment. We see people like Oliver Goldsmith. Everybody's read Oliver Goldsmith, right? He's a very popular 18th century writer. He was a historian, he was a playwright, a poet, and he seems to get a lot of play in this. We see a lot of history. David Hume's History of England. He was actually more famous in his lifetime as a historian than he was as a philosopher. Charles Roland's Ancient History, just above that, which is kind of the standard bedrock of classical history that people would have known during the Revolution and Constitution era. Not much fiction showing up there. There is one work of fiction that manages to break in, and this might partly be because, again, there aren't 15-volume novels. But we do see a 3-volume Scottish Chiefs by Jane Porter working in. Jane Porter was a contemporary of Jane Austen, was actually much more popular than Austen in both Britain and the United States. And the Scottish Chiefs is kind of her version of Braveheart. As we go further down, we do see a little more fiction showing up. Her sister, Anna Maria Porter, comes in at number 15 with the Hungarian brothers. Sir Walter Scott makes it on, but only as a poet, not as a novelist, despite the fact that he's now remembered for Rob Roy, Ivanhoe, Waverly, these kinds of works. And there's also very little American stuff if we leave out the magazines, which often are publishing a mishmash of American and European material. The first American work that shows up on this list is number 14, just above the Hungarian brothers, Mason Weems' Life of Washington. This is the version of the Life of Washington that includes the cherry tree story. He's the guy who started that. And that's a one-volume work, but it made it up above most of the rest of the collection. So that clearly does seem to have a lot of popularity to it. The first work of American fiction comes in right here at number 17, The Sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon by Washington Irving. This is where the stories Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow are first published. And my literary history course right now, we're actually right this week even trying to formulate some theories as to why it's Irving and why it's this particular work of Irving's, because he has older books that are on the shelves in the ELC. Why it's this one that breaks the top 20? What is it about this that gets so much popularity? Especially for the years that we're looking at, this book's only been on the shelf 5 or 6 years at this point. Some of the others have been on the shelf over 15. And clearly there's something about Irving. He even managed to beat out Don Quixote here, despite Don Quixote coming in at 4 volumes compared to 2. So what does this tell us about reading? Well, it tells us that people make different choices at different points in history. It also tells us that we don't necessarily know a whole lot from running these numbers. What we get from running these numbers is figuring out what next questions to ask. We wouldn't have known to ask the question about the sketchbook if we hadn't run these numbers. We wouldn't think to look at people like Jane Porter alongside Washington Irving if we hadn't run these numbers. So this kind of digital humanities project is helpful not just for giving us answers, but for giving us answers that lead to new and better questions. And that's what I'm excited about as we move further through this. The interface is pretty far along in development at this point. I'm hoping that we'll be able to release that soon. But hopefully this gives you a little bit of a taste of what this aggregated collection will be able to do. This is one reason why these library records had just been sitting there. If you wanted to know how many times Don Quixote had been taken out, you would just have to go through and count them page after page after page. This is essentially what we've been doing with transcription, but now the computer can count it for us, and we can wind up with these totals that we can start comparing and run against other issues. For example, how many times are female borrowers taking out Washington Irving compared to male borrowers? We can start to ask those kinds of questions. So that gets us into these issues about the choices that happen before the reading itself occurs. What other kinds of evidence might we look for? Here's where I'm going to switch off this part of the screen and move us over to another project and another kind of evidence. As Pat said in her introduction, I'm working on a study right now that I'm calling the Hymnal Before the Notes. Before the 1850s, hymn books did not have music in them. It wasn't economically viable to do that with the printing technology available. So that meant that these books tended to only have words in them. One other thing that's very important about this particular era in the history of hymn books, which start to come into use around 1700, Isaac Watts has a lot to do with that, is churches did not provide these. Churches adopted hymn books the way that professors adopt textbooks. They say, this is what we're going to use, go buy it. And so individual families had to buy their own hymn books, and unless you were in a very well-to-do church where you rented pews and you could leave your hymn book in your private pew during the week, that meant you had to schlep the book back and forth. And this is an example of one of those books that was schlepped between home and church and possibly the office, and possibly a field, and possibly school, and other places. This is how big that hymn book is. This is what's called a 16 mo. This is about half the size of what the pages of that Washington Irving book would have been. 16 refers to how many leaves you get once you fold the paper over. The sheet is folded down into very, very small size, and this is partly for portability. It's partly for being able to sell this cheap. I'm going to show you a little bit of what is in this book and what kinds of things we might be able to figure out about how this book was read. Now, one caveat before I do that. Michael Suarez, who was our Schluter lecturer last year, has put kind of a warning label on this kind of work. He says that any recorded reading is perforce an anomalous reading. I'll say that again. Any recorded reading is perforce an anomalous reading. In this project, I've been looking for marginalia. I've been looking for different signs of use, signs of exchange, inscriptions that people have written. All those things are, in the wide scheme of all the hymn books that were produced, all the hymn books that were used, it's a pretty small minority. But there are other things that we might be able to work with beyond these marks of what we traditionally think of as reading. First, let's start with talking about production. Getting a look at the little title page of this, but we'll see if we can get the focus to show up here. There we go. This is Hymns and Spiritual Songs in Three Books by Isaac Watts. This is his original hymn collection that originally came out in 1707. What we see as we look further down this title page is that this is an 1819 reprinting of this. There are a couple of other things we can tell from this title page that give us a little bit of a sense of how this particular book worked in the market that it was a part of. We see that it's published in Exeter, New Hampshire, by a man named John Williams, who was part of a kind of a steady seller firm. He didn't publish a lot of new stuff. He published stuff that people had sold thousands and thousands of copies of before, and so he figured, well, I can sell a few hundred more of those. There's a ready market for that. The other interesting thing here is Stereotyped by B. and J. Collins. We get the word stereotype when we talk about stereotyping people from printing. This was a practice that was developed in the early 19th century of setting the type where you get all the letters in the rows, you lock the whole thing in what's called a form, and then you make a mold of all of that. Then you can cast new plates from that, and those plates are called stereotype plates. This is something you would do if you had a book that either used a whole lot of type, or more often the reason was you knew that you were going to want to sell another edition of it later on. And it's a huge labor-saving device to cast these stereotype plates. It's also expensive to do that, so you don't do it with every single book that you make as a publisher. But you do it with the ones that you think are just going to keep coming back and back and back. And these hymn books were prime material for this. 1819 is actually very early to see stereotyping in the United States. And the fact that it's done by this firm, B&J Collins, this is a Connecticut, New York-based firm who specialize in Bible printing. Bibles are the other genre, along with hymn books, that have a very early market for stereotyping. You always need Bibles. You always need hymn books. So people will keep reprinting these. So one thing we can say about this is that this is a mass market item. This was a book that was meant to be produced in the thousands and then have thousands more produced like it afterwards that would have very cheap type, very cheap paper. You can see it's looking pretty brown. And the type also comes very, very close to the edge of the pages. You don't want to use any excess with this. You're trying to keep the cost as low as possible so that you can move these things literally by the barrel. That's often how they were shipped. And it would have had this little leather cover slapped onto it before it went out and would have been sold really all across the country. And how we know that these things moved all across the country is from inscriptions like the one in this book. Coral Woodford, property book, not quite sure why it's phrased that way, Robeson County, North Carolina, price 34 cents. So this is a book that was written in Britain in the first part of the 18th century. Became so popular over the course of a century that people in New England were reprinting it by the hundreds and by the thousands. They were stereotyping it and they were shipping it over 1,000 miles at a time to consumers to sell 34 cents each. To put that in perspective, that copy of the sketchbook, which comes out in 1819 in the first edition as well, would have sold for about $1.25. So this is a bargain basement book. So we have a sense of the market. We have a sense that this is a mass-produced item. It's a commodity. We have a sense of this very large reach, this, in fact, transatlantic reach of the hymn book market. But what about reading? What do we know that Coral Woodford did with this book? Well, there isn't marginalia in this book. There isn't any systematic dog earing of pages that's done. So we can't know automatically what it is that Woodford was up to with this book. Unless maybe we take a little bit of a closer look at the cover. I'm not sure exactly how well this is going to show up on the dot cam. One thing that you can probably, oh, there we go. If I tilt it a little bit, you can get a little bit of the sense of the change in color. The color is not uniform on this cover. It isn't on this side either. There's also a bit of wear right here along the front edge of the hinge. The tanning that would have been done on this leather can wear off over time. This is something that book historians love to work with because they're always interested to see, is there a really interesting piece of scrap paper that had something printed on it that you find underneath? There have actually been early American pornographic books that have been found that way, where the publisher decided they needed to get rid of the pages in a hurry, turned it into junk paper, and it turned into covers that eventually wear off if enough sweat, hand oil, that kind of thing, rubs the tanning off. Turns out that's what's happened to this book. It sat on the heel of the hand, and then we could see where the fingers went on the front of it, and the fingers were rubbing the hinge right here. What we can know about this book is that it was read a lot. This was a book that its owner lived with, held for hours and hours and hours in church and probably also at home. It's a book that was made by a New England firm as a mass commodity to live with a human being and to change, potentially, that human being. How the change happened in Coral Woodford's life is a mystery we will probably never be able to solve. But we do know that it was a book that presumably she lived with. Now let me take a moment to adjust the technology. We'll think about that and then see what all this might mean.